Just give me a little time to get situated here. It simply said that I'm giving a presentation, but if it had a title, it would be The Nature and the History of American Christian Nationalism. Knowing me, you shouldn't be surprised that I would be emphasizing the historical dimension. I think we've already been well introduced to the subject, but I would like to call attention to a couple of quotes from Manfred Brock. A few of us were privileged to hear him give presentations on the subject. He's a professor, a retired professor from what today is Palmer Theological Seminary. And so on the side of the handout you should have, there's a series of quotes, and I would like to call attention to a couple of them. Christian nationalism is the belief that we are a nation defined by Christianity, and our national and state laws should privilege this heritage by taking active steps to keep it this way. And the next one is Christian nationalism is a cultural framework, idealizing and promoting a fusion of a particular expression of Christianity with American civil life. And one more, Christian nationalism is a political, religious, cultural identity fueled by fear that sees people of other religions and cultural identities as a threat to its identity and culture if we do not preserve our cultural and religious heritage. Well, to illustrate the concept of Christian nationalism, I've decided to review one of the early American settlements, the Puritans of New England. Certain features of that society were passed down during the colonial era and persisted until the present time, evolving into this phenomenon that we're calling Christian nationalism. Now, the first of these qualities I'd like to examine is the doctrine of exceptionalism. They saw themselves as chosen by God to a particular special divine mission. William Bradford, the governor of the Pilgrim Band, in deciding to migrate, said, "We have great hope for the propagating and advancing the gospel of the kingdom of Christ in those remote parts of the world." John Winthrop of the Massachusetts Bay Colony referred to their effort as a city set on a hill. And on another occasion, the new Zion in the wilderness. Now, with this sense of exceptional relationship with God, they assumed that they had special privileges and would call this entitlement. They also assumed a cultural superiority, and in their social hierarchy, some of the individuals in the community saw themselves as having a higher rank than the others. John Winthrop in 1630 said, "God Almighty in his most holy and wise providence so disposed of the condition of mankind as in all times, some must be rich, some poor, some high and eminent in power and dignity, and others lowly in subjection." And of course, on the lowest rungs of the social ladder were the slaves and the indentured servants, and only those who owned property were permitted to vote or to hold public office. Considering the Puritans' views on exceptionalism and social hierarchy, It's not surprising they subscribe to the doctrine of discovery. This was a proclamation by the church that a Christian nation had the right to possess lands of non-Christians in the interest of saving their souls. After 1492, Columbus' contact with the New World, they actually had the papal decree that confirmed this, and it was used by various nations to justify pushing the natives aside and taking over their space. Well, the Puritans had a state church in which religion and politics were united. Only church members could vote or hold public office, and the religious regulations were administered by local magistrates. And although reading the Bible was a top priority, and in fact a primary reason for their strong emphasis on learning, interpretation and application were under the direction of the clergy. Many of the Puritans came to Massachusetts to escape religious persecution, but upon arrival, they proved to be as intolerant as the English state church. I often think about how it is oftentimes that the abused become abusers. Roger Williams, who had a high regard for the natives and criticized Puritan religious practices, was forced to leave the colony. He proceeded to start a new settlement. He named Providence, it becomes Rhode Island, as you know, which Governor Winthrop contemptuously described as that sewer where the Lord's debris hath collected and rotted. Anne Hutchinson, a charismatic midwife, challenged the local ministers by hosting discussion groups in her home. Seen as a threat to church authority and patriarchy, she was banished from Massachusetts. In 1659 and 60, five Quakers, after severe corporal punishment, were actually hanged on the Boston Common. They were barred by law from entering Massachusetts, and they were not like perhaps a typical stereotype we have of Quakers, because they were zealous proselytes, and they, along with others, had caused considerable unrest, engaging in extreme measures such as disrupting church services and courtroom gatherings. Now, of course, the most notable example of Puritan religious fanatic persecution would be the 1692 execution of 14 women and 5 men in Salem who were accused of witchcraft. Now, in the years that followed, these components of Christian nationalism continued. In 1845, during the consideration of the annexation of Texas, John L. Sullivan, a New York journalist, invoked the doctrine of exceptionalism and the doctrine of discovery when he declared that it is our manifest destiny to overspread the continent allotted by Providence for the free development of our yearly multiplying millions. He urged the annexation of Texas and bringing elements of civilization to the western wilderness, stating that it was our God-given right to expand from sea to sea, planting democracy, capitalism, and Christianity along the way. Well, disregarding the presence of the natives at the urging of President Polk, Texas and the Oregon Territory were added, along with New Mexico and California soon to follow. In the 1840s and the early 50s, a movement developed known as nativism. It emerged to ensure the people born in the United States were considered, who considered themselves as natives, and really they weren't, of course. They wanted to receive better treatment than the immigrants. And this was largely a response to the significant influx of Irish who came to America fleeing the tragic consequences of the famine brought on by the potato blight. They were stereotyped as shiftless, lower-class whiskey-drinking rowdies who stole jobs away from others more deserving. However, the major count against them was their Catholic identity. The specific charge was the fear that their highly hierarchical structure in the Roman Catholic Church would threaten democracy. In times, thanks to their contribution in building roads and canals and railroads and a stellar role in the Civil War, they found acceptance to the point that annually Americans today devote one day to wearing the green and celebrating Irish culture. That's good news. Stereotypes can be broken. I admit that I make an annual pilgrimage in mid-March to McDonald's to get my delicious shamrock shake. It's good that you don't serve it all the time. Today's largest Protestant body, the Southern Baptist Convention, was formed by those who defended the institution of slavery. It should not be surprising then that discriminating post-Civil War Jim Crow laws passed to keep blacks in their place were given their overt and silent support. Studies have shown that lynchings of blacks were often carried out in the framework of the Christian congregation. Chapel Hill professor Donald G. Matthews characterized it as communal lynching in the context of a sacred order designed to sustain holiness. And you may know that the Ku Klux Klan was a terrorist organization determined to maintain white supremacy and defend American and Christian values. And many of the Klan leaders were respected statesmen and Christian preachers. And in some chapters, only church members were accepted into the Klan. Now, as the 19th century moved into the 20th, under the leadership of Presidents William McKinley and Theodore Roosevelt, the United States became a world power with their growing brood of colonies. As the concept of manifest destiny was given a global application. After winning, in the words of Theodore Roosevelt, a splendid little war with Spain, the Philippine Islands were in the hands of the United States. President McKinley was faced with strong pressure to make these islands a U.S. territory, as they had done with Puerto Rico and Guam. Now, there was something about McKinley. If you know your presidents, he was about the most godly of them all. And I'm not saying that facetiously. This was really true. He reminds you of Jimmy Carter as far as his piety is concerned. But facing this dilemma, he said he made it a matter of prayer. And in his own words, he related that on one occasion, while on his knees, the answer came: annex the Philippines and Christianize them. Now, this decision was referred to as benevolent assimilation. That resulted in one of the worst, most tragic incidents in our country's history. It was a 3-year guerrilla war between the Philippines and the United States, known for atrocities on both sides. The results were 4,200 American and 16,000 Filipino soldiers were killed, and civilian casualties were said to have been in the tens of thousands. Now, it happened that the original war with Spain lasted 2 months with 400 American deaths. And the Philippines had already been Christianized by a strong Catholic effort. It's sort of a shame because they really wanted their independence from Spain. That's sort of why the war began in the first place. But now, after they got rid of Spain, they still didn't get what they wanted. It wasn't until 1948 that our country really gave them their independence as they have it today. In 1967, a sociologist, Robert Bellow, published what he called Civil Religion in America. And that's a term now that you're going to hear quite a bit during this period. He described Americanism as a religious faith based on an institutional collection of sacred symbols and observances drawn from national history. And during this time, several movements developed that promoted American exceptionalism and initiated means to promote and defend the United States as a Christian nation. No one did more for the cause of civil religion than David Barton, an evangelical author whose Texas-based Wall Builders promoted his books and audiovisuals. His two-volume American Godly Heritage was used as a textbook in private religious schools, and it minimized the Constitution's separation of church and state and maintained that 95% of the founding fathers were Christians who succeeded in establishing a Christian nation. I could go on and on talking about this. First, who were these actual Christian founders that they referred to? And they were religious, there's no doubt about that. But if you think of the Virginians, that's Washington and Madison and Jefferson and Monroe, Patrick Henry and some of the others, they would have been, well, Episcopalians. They were not Baptists or Methodists or Anabaptists, and most of them would be referred to as deists. That is, they believed in a divine creator, but it doesn't go much farther than that. I'm not sure it's quite right, because if you read what they wrote in letters and in material that was published, they did believe in prayer, which suggests that they did feel that God did have some kind of contact with the creation. But certainly they were not Orthodox Christians as we would think of it today. Maybe the exception would be John Adams. He was quite a pious Unitarian, a little different than the others. But even Benjamin Franklin, talked about prayer at the Constitutional Convention. Well, Barton gave particular attention to George Washington, based a lot of his information on the Mason Weems biography of Washington published in 1800. And that, along with other fictional anecdotes, included a detailed account of Washington praying at Valley Forge. Now, I wouldn't be surprised he did pray at Valley Forge. I would have too if I'd have been in a situation like he was in. But there's this painting that's become kind of a national icon of Washington in the snow, bowed down on one knee beside his trusty steed in prayer. Well, fact-checking would reveal that the person that apparently saw him and talked about it and went home to his wife and told her about it, he wasn't anywhere close to Valley Forge at the time and wasn't married at that time. But that's a picture, a painting, you see it in one of the buildings down in the Capitol, and gets a lot of publicity. And talk about the stories that were in this biography of Washington. That has to do with what? Cutting up that sapling cherry tree. And there's one in there talking about how great an army he had. He threw a silver dollar all the way across the Rappahannock River. And that makes you wonder a little bit. But these are some of the kinds of stories that were in this. And one of the most spectacular expressions of American Christian nationalism is the apotheosis of George Washington. And I don't know if you've ever seen it, or maybe you did and you don't remember, or you didn't know what it was. But that's a painting in the opening of the Capitol Dome, and it's depicting Washington with heavenly hosts after his metamorphosis from human to divine. He became a god. And that's portrayed there by Brumidi, who did a lot of the paintings there in the Capitol building. David Barton's son, Timothy, recently released a book entitled The Bulletproof George Washington. And that's an account how Washington was miraculously preserved from harm as an officer in the French and Indian War in order to eventually perform God's special mission of orchestrating America's independence from Great Britain. But he had a couple horses shot out from under him. And there, much as he wrote a whole book on it, which I have never read, but I hope to sometime. Barton has his flagship organization, the Wall Builders, currently sponsors the Patriot Academy under the direction of Texas ex-Congressman Rick Green. Here, men and women between the ages of 18 and 25 attend a 5-day camp where they take classes providing instruction from the Bible and the Constitution, supplemented with 4 hours a day of intense combat and gun training. Jerry Falwell Sr. played a key role in mobilizing Christian conservatives as a major political force. This is where they were sort of aligned with the Republican right, you might say. He was the chancellor of the Fundamentalist Christian Liberty College, now a university in Lynchburg, Virginia. He was a pastor of a mega church, the Thomas Road Baptist Church of 20,000 members, and a television preacher with an audience of an estimated 50 million. He and his associates launched the Moral Majority in 1979. And they spoke out loudly against abortion, homosexuality, sexual promiscuity, feminism, evolution, communism, and Supreme Court rulings against prayer and Bible reading in public schools. In 1955, Carl McIntyre, a pastor of the Bible Presbyterian Church in Collingswood, New Jersey, launched his 20th Century Reformation Hour. It was a daily radio broadcast because, in his words, once the country honored God, and now the freedom was in danger of losing its heritage. In his obituary in the March 23rd edition of the Los Angeles Times, he was identified as a firebrand fundamentalist and father of the religious right who railed against communism, liberalism, racial integration, sex education, evolution, and water fluoridation. He had a strong following in the Bucksmont area, especially in the Baptist population, as well as some local Mennonites. On June 1st, 1964, a meeting took place in the Blooming Glen Mennonite Church that received considerable publicity. There were 4 Russian Baptist preachers that had been invited to tour Mennonite churches in our country, and Carl McIntyre heard about this and began to preach about it. And from 50 to 100 militants, I'm going to call them, they came to protest the service there with their placards and bullhorns. 8 years later, on July 23rd, 1972, that scene was repeated at the Plains Mennonite Church. There were four Russian Baptist ministers, and I don't know if they're the same ones. And incidentally, they were invited as Baptist ministers because at that time, the Mennonites in Russia were under the umbrella of the Russian Baptists. The Russian Baptists had status with the government, which the Mennonites did not have. And so that was a convenient way to deal with that. Anyway, there were 200 picketers. They were bused from New Jersey just to be there for the occasion. Now, McIntyre claimed that the Mennonites were naive and were actually dupes because these four were really communist agents advocating peaceful coexistence. Now, in both cases, things remained relatively peaceful due to a police presence and the calm and well-orchestrated leadership of bishops Richard Detweiler in the first case and John E. Lapp in the second. Now, of course, the January 6, 2011 event was a demonstration of Christian nationalism going amok. After breaking into the Senate chamber, Jacob Chansley, with fur and horned headpiece, delivered a prayer thanking God for allowing the United States to be reborn. There were banners with Christian slogans, a large wooden cross, and a picture of an American flag wrapped around an assault rifle that seemed to justify hatred in the name of Christianity. Now, one of the banners in this riot showed a green pine tree on a white field, which was used during the American Revolution to symbolize God's deliverance of the colonies from British tyranny. Today, it has been renamed the Appeal to Heaven flag as a symbol of an aggressive vision of Christian nationalists driven by spiritual warfare and prophecy, intent to remake America in the image of a very conservative Christianity. That sentence was in quotes. Today, they still spread the word that the 2020 presidential election was stolen and Donald Trump, like Cyrus of old, is God's anointed. You know, and the recent controversy pertaining to the Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito and the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, are presently in the news. Well, what difference does it really make? Does it really matter? And I would like to now call attention to a couple of the quotes on the sheet. That'd be lines 6 through 10. Which do talk about it in terms of the dangers. Christian nationalism is dangerous for America because it tends to treat other Americans as second-class citizens, fails to respect the full religious liberty of all Americans. It promotes morals legislation to regulate conduct that would tend our nation toward a morality peace state, and it fosters an ideology held overwhelmingly by Christian Americans and creates fear and the belief that Christians are victims of persecution. Another statement is Christian nationalism is dangerous for the church because the real mission of the church is to speak the truth, acting in love, promoting justice, and welcoming the stranger and caring about the lost, the least, and the less. Now, on the outline, I have put something down where I'm distinguishing between Christian nationalism and the Jesus model. In Christian nationalism, you have an authoritarian assertion of power to control and to dominate. But the Jesus model is leadership through servanthood and invitation to join and participate. Christian nationalism, well, that's revenge and personal vendettas. In a way, I feel like I got to be careful what I say and what I'm about to say. I'm afraid that if I get too political, the IRS will find out about it and the church will lose its tax-exempt status. But one of the candidates for the coming election has made it very clear that one of the first things he plans to do is to get revenge for himself and revenge for all of the other people in the country. He will do that. But the Jesus model is forgiveness and reconciliation. Christian nationalism, it's racial and social and gender hierarchies. But you have a verse here in Galatians that says it very well as far as the Jesus model. In Jesus Christ, there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. We are all one in Christ Jesus. And Christian nationalism is motivated by competition and rugged individualism. But the Jesus model is motivated by a sense of community and the general welfare. In Christian nationalism, national priorities dominate, but in the Jesus model, there's that strong global perspective. In thinking about this subject, I tend to become quite cynical. I find it hard to believe that persons could actually believe that God sanctioned slavery, displacement of Native Americans, or the January 6th riot. Did their action really grow out of a desire to be a faithful Christian? Or was their Christian identity a justification for other motives? I find myself concluding that it's a case of capitalist wolves dressing in Christian sheep's clothing. Well, allowing for the fact that some proponents of Christian nationalism reach their conclusions sincerely, and I think we should remember that. If I myself, perhaps being critical of conservatives in politics rather than just those that are involved in Christian nationalism. But I am going to conclude by listing a few things here in terms of how Christians might respond. One is to keep informed in order to know what it is and how it conflicts with true Christianity. To counter it in a positive way by centering on the teachings of Jesus. To build relationships with those from different cultures and dissimilar political and religious perspectives. Support agencies and events that are committed to social justice. Hold persons accountable for the Christian values they say they live by. Keep pressure on those in power to advocate for those marginalized in terms of race, religion, gender, sexuality, incarnation, etc. And then the last one is for us to demonstrate the biblical instruction to love our neighbor in our daily walk of life. Now, I think it was planned, at least it was announced, that during the second hour, there'd be a time when we can sit down and discuss my input or something perhaps that you'd like, you know, to bring out. And I will have a few copies of these recommendations or responses on the tables there. That would be helpful.